So I'll be talking about several different spin effects in nanostructures. And the strategy we're taking along these lines is to work in metal devices with the idea that by changing what metals we work with, we can change the nature of the interactions acting on the spins and on the electrons. For instance, if you pick a nice metal like cobalt or iron, you can get a ferromagnet with a large macroscopic spin, give you sort of spin-dependent transmission and reflection coefficients, play lots of nice games with that. And also by changing atomic number, you can change the amount of spin orbit scattering in devices. And so we'll play around with these various types of interactions. And I changed my plan a little bit today. My group's working on three projects along these lines, but in the interest of lunch, I'll only talk about two. I'll start a bit with the effects of spin orbit scattering in noble metal nanoparticles, asking how do spin orbit effects affect the discrete electronic states that we can measure inside very small grains. We'll hear later on this week about spin orbit effects in two-dimensional semiconductor quantum dots, where the two-dimensionality produces some subtleties that are very interesting. In these three-dimensional metal dots, it turns out those effects aren't there. And actually, it's a fairly simple story to understand the effects of the spin orbit interactions. I won't talk about the second subject because it will be treated in this afternoon's talks with Jan van Delft and Alan MacDonald. There, the subject is what are the electronic states really like inside a magnetic nanoparticle, where you really have to take into account strong exchange interactions and also the real quantum mechanics of a many-body interacting state. You get to a regime where the simple stoner models really don't work at all for understanding of the discrete electronic states, and it becomes a much more interesting story. But we'll save that for this afternoon. The last subject that we'll talk about are putting spin effects to work in small devices. Here, the discovery and working out an effect where by applying spin-polarized currents inside devices, you can apply torques to magnets, actually producing magnetic reversal or nice dynamical states. I'll show you some data about how that works. And also, I think it's a nice story for this audience because the same types of theoretical constructs you use in mesoscopic physics for calculating conductance, things like the Landauer formula, you can use those in very direct ways to calculate these sorts of torques as well, taking into account spin-dependent scattering mechanisms. Okay, so just to start with, we've had a number of different experiments over the last few years where we've been using tunneling to measure discrete electronic states in metal devices. And so the first subject I'll talk to you about uses those same kind of geometries where we take a small metal particle and we connect it to two metal electrodes through aluminum oxide tunnel junctions, and then we can use tunneling spectroscopy to measure the discrete electronic states inside that particle. The nature of the measurement is to apply a source drain voltage across the device. You have strong Coulomb blockade effects in these devices, so for small voltages you don't produce any current. But then when the voltage is turned up enough that electrons have enough energy to tunnel onto the discrete states of the device, current turns on, and it turns on in a discrete stepwise way where each step corresponds to tunneling through a different quantum eigenstate on the particle. So by measuring current as a function of source drain voltage, you can measure both the ground state and excited states in the particle. Okay, so I'll show you some old data to start with because it's simple. If you measure something like aluminum, where the atomic number is small and spin orbit effects are weak, you see very simple physics. Here, I've taken one more derivative, so I'm plotting the differential conductance versus energy, which is proportional to source drain voltage. You see a number of discrete peaks due to tunneling through these individual eigenstates. And if you apply a magnetic field, the eigenstates just undergo Zeeman splitting due to having spin up and spin down electrons. In aluminum, the dependence on magnetic fields is entirely linear. States can pass through each other. And by measuring the magnitude of the splitting, you can get out the G factor. And for almost all the aluminum devices we measure, the G factor is 2. Okay. But things will become a little bit more complicated as we go to other materials and we start adding in some spin orbit scattering. Okay, so you can add a little bit of spin orbit scattering just by going to copper. So here's some similar data from a copper device. And I've also turned things 90 degrees, so I'm plotting voltage or energy on this scale and magnetic field on this scale. You still see a similar kind of Zeeman splitting effect, but there's a number of differences from what we saw with aluminum. First of all, at low magnetic field, the splitting is still linear, but if you measure the G factor for each state, it can differ for each state. It's reduced below 2. And you see a wide variety of different G factors depending on exactly which state you're looking at. The other effect you see is that unlike in aluminum, where when a spin-up and spin-down state came together, they just underwent a simple crossing, here there's a coupling between spin-up and spin-down states because of the spin-orbit effect. And for instance, you see avoided crossings instead. So those are the two main effects of spin-orbit scattering I'll be talking about. Those can both be understood in a very simple way, even just within simple perturbation theory. So if you think about the unperturbed states being the discrete electron and box states on the particle with no spin orbit effects, and then turn up the spin orbit effect within perturbation theory, you get both these effects immediately. First of all, the G factor will be reduced below 2 because the true eigenstates aren't pure spin states anymore, but they're linear superpositions of spin up and spin down, and so they'll have less dependence on their energy will depend less strongly on the magnetic field. And in particular, if you calculate what the G factor should be, it just works out to be this formula in spin-orbit theory. And this tells you that you should expect to see fluctuations in the G factor from state to state, both because the matrix elements coupling different orbital states will be different, and also because you'll have differences in level spacing, and both of those effects should give you fluctuations in the G factor. The avoided crossings come out as well. In the region where two states come together near a crossing, you can think about reducing the problem just to a 2x2 Hamiltonian, and the spin-orbit scattering will couple the spin-up and spin-down states, and it's easy to see that you'll get an avoided crossing, where the magnitude of the avoided crossing will just be twice the matrix element of the spin-orbit scattering part of the Hamiltonian. So that's a simple way to understand things qualitatively. If you really want to get quantitative, you have to be a little bit more fancy. And that's been done both by Pete Brower and his collaborators and Kasia Matveyev and his collaborators, where they worked within random matrix theory to understand how having spin-orbit scattering would change both the average value of the G-factor and what the standard deviations of the ensemble of G-factors should be as well. And so if you want, Pete is here and co-authors on the other paper here as well. If you have questions about theory, I encourage you to talk to them. But this is the calculation we'll be making a comparison to. And so the comparison really comes down to just one graph, where here I'll plot for a number of different samples sort of the integrated probability for having G factors within the distribution we measure, where each of the dots corresponds to G factor for individual state, and we've just ordered them to sort of simulate the integrated probability. And the lines are curves from the Pete Brower's theory for what the distribution of the G factor should be for a given value of spin orbit scattering strength within one of the devices. And you can see a number of things you expect. First of all, as you increase the atomic number, you get more and more spin orbit interactions. So copper has relatively high G factors, silver has less, and gold has very small G factors. And for any particular sample, you can use the average value of the G factor to determine what the magnitude of the spin orbit scattering strength should be within the random matrix theory. And then given that number, that the distribution actually fits very nicely to the standard deviations we measure for each sample. One thing that surprised us initially was if you look at different particles formed of the same material, that you can get significantly different amounts of spin orbit scattering, even for particles that have nominally the same volume and therefore have about the same level spacing. These two copper samples here have almost exactly the same average level spacing, but you can see that the distributions are shifted quite a bit from each other. That turns out not to be too surprising in the end. What people know from, say, electron spin resonance studies of spin orbit scattering is that much of the reduction of the G factor comes from the combination of spin orbit scattering in the bulk and just elastic scattering from the surface of the material. So you expect that particles that differ, say, in surface to volume ratio might very well have different spin-orbit scattering strengths on this sort of level. One last thing we can do is we can extract a mean spin-orbit scattering time from these devices, and we do find reasonable agreement with other types of measurements on larger samples, both from weak localization on quench condensed films and ESR line width numbers on thin metal films. If you scale those down to about the mean free paths we have in our devices, those agree well. So there's nothing strange going on with the spin orbit scattering in these devices. It's what you'd expect from extrapolations in larger systems. Okay, so that's the spin orbit scattering story. I now want to move on to this effect of spin transfer, applying torques to magnets using spin polarized currents. And the first thing I want to emphasize is this is different than magnetic fields. It's a second mechanism by which electric currents can influence magnets, and it has different symmetries. You're all familiar with one way that currents can influence magnets. If you send a current through a device like this, which is sort of the topology I'll be talking about, where you're sending current perpendicularly through layers of magnetic and non-magnetic materials, you can get magnetic fields going around the wire, and that can sort of form magnetic vortices in magnetic materials and things like that. That's not what I'll be talking about. The effect I'll be talking about will be due to exchange interactions in space. It will have different symmetries, and that the torques that are applied by this mechanism will tend to want to align or anti-align the magnets in the devices. There won't be any kind of vortex motion involved. These two effects do compete with each other. In order for this effect to be dominant, it turns out you need to be smaller than about 200 nanometers or so for the cross-section of your devices. And we have a number of ways for making devices on that scale now. That's why these effects have become apparent as we go through things. Okay, but what I want to do, I think, is just approach this from a theoretical basis first, just thinking about why there should be such an effect, and then I'll show you some of the data. So this effect was actually predicted about 5 years ago by two theorists, John Sanzuski at IBM and Luc Berger at Carnegie Mellon. And there's a fairly simple way to understand intuitively why it comes about. It comes about because of spin-dependent scattering in a magnet. And there's sort of two ingredients to think about. One, a spin filtering effect that occurs as electrons encounter a magnetic film, and the other, spin precession that occurs as electrons go inside and traverse through a magnetic film. So I'll discuss those two separately to begin with, though they'll be combined in one formalism at the end. The first simplest way to think about it is just to imagine that if you have a thin magnetic film with electrons incident on it, the magnetic film will act as a spin filter. It will allow different transmission for spin up versus spin down electrons. So for simplicity at the beginning, imagine that this thin film is a perfect spin filter. It will allow sort of spin up electrons to go through, and it will reflect spin up, spin down electrons back. Okay. And then we can ask what happens if we come in with a spin plus current at some angle relative to the magnetization of that magnet. And I do that simply because if you have zero angle here, there's no torque, but any finite angle, you will have some torque involved. Okay, so you have a simple picture. If you come in with that spin plus current, it will be filtered by the magnet. You'll get components of spin up electrons transmitted through. You'll get components of spin down electrons reflected back. And that's the whole story. The only thing left to do is to ask, well, what happens to the angular momentum in this picture? I can calculate the angular momentum flux going into the magnet from the left. I can calculate the angular momentum flux going out of the magnet. If there's any net angular momentum flux, what that means is in the process of filtering, the magnet must be absorbing some angular momentum, which means it must be feeling a torque. And so the key point here is that unlike charge currents, spin currents don't have to be conserved as they encounter a magnet. If there's spin-dependent scattering going on, magnets can act as sources or sinks of spin angular momentum, and so that means that they can feel torques from these kinds of effects. And so it's easy to see what's going on here. For the incident electrons, there's a component of angular momentum in the horizontal direction, and for the electrons coming out from the magnet, there's no component of angular momentum in that direction. So that means that the magnet must be absorbing some angular momentum in the horizontal direction, which means that it must be feeling a torque in that direction. So whenever you have spin filtering in a magnetic film, you'll also have torques from this kind of mechanism. And the torque will be such as to want to align the moment of the magnet, move it toward the direction of the incoming spin. Okay, so that's one intuitive mechanism to think about things. The other intuitive mechanism involves precession of spins. So here I want to imagine that we've somehow gotten the electrons through the interface between a non-magnetic and magnetic film, and we have a current of electrons in the x direction, say, moving within a magnet where the magnetization is pointing in the z direction. So at the initial point here, x equals 0, we just have electrons pointed in the x direction, which if you write it in terms of spin up and spin down wave functions, is just that combination of things. Okay, now as this electron current moves through the magnet, we know how to write down the electron wave function. There'll be phases that develop just due to the plane wave motion of electrons. And the important point is there'll be different wave vectors for the spin up and spin down electrons because of the differences in their band structure. They'll just have different wavelengths. And so if you write down how the wave function progresses as it goes along, there'll be a phase that develops between the spin up and spin down electron components of the electron wave function. And quantum mechanically, all that means is that the electron spin will precess around the direction of the magnetization just due to the exchange field inside the magnet. Nothing too complicated there. Okay. Now if you want to calculate a torque here, in a normal situation you'll have electrons incident with a variety of different energies or coming in at a variety of different angles. You'll develop different amounts of phase between those electron wave functions, and so as you progress through the magnet in a normal kind of experimental situation, those phases will get messed up. On average, if you've gone some number of Fermi wavelengths in the material, you won't have any coherence left in that kind of precession between different electron wave functions. So what that means in a normal kind of mesoscopic average, the angular momentum perpendicular to the magnetization coming out the other side of the magnet will be pretty much zero. And so it becomes then easy to think about what the angular momentum does. You have angular momentum in the x direction when you start. When you finish, you don't have any of that angular momentum left over. So again, in this picture, the magnet will have to be absorbing that that x component of the angular momentum. And you have the same result as we had for the simple spin filtering picture. Now, if you want to calculate those two things together, you can within a scattering picture. You can just view your magnetic thin film as a black box, which will just have some reflection and transmission coefficients. With precession, the transmission and reflection coefficients will be complex, so you can count these precessional factors, but that's not hard to take into account. And you can do exactly the same kind of thing where you calculate with the angular momentum coming in from the left to the device, the angular momentum going out to the right, and just calculate the torque as the difference of angular momentum that occurs in those devices. That's a simple calculation, and you get these sorts of formulas. You don't have any torque in the z direction. The torque is always perpendicular to the direction of the magnetization of the magnet. The main torque is in the x direction if the incident electrons are polarized in the xz plane. There will be some torque in the y direction due to imperfect averaging as the electrons precess around, but that will normally be a small torque. So usually the torque will be in the direction I've drawn it here. The magnetization will want to push in the direction of the incident electrons as they come in.
It looks like another.
Right, so this is before an average, and then you'd want to average over this afterward, being careful about the complex nature of the transmission reflection coefficients. Yeah, so this is without the averaging here. Experimentalists can do the calculations without the averaging. For averaging, you need people like me. So just to summarize the picture then, these non-equilibrium torques are a bit different than the torques you normally encounter in magnetic systems in equilibrium. The main effect of the non-equilibrium torque is sort of a torque in the plane of, say, the two magnetic moments of a polarizer-analyzer system. If one magnetic film is used to polarize the magnet so electrons come out in that direction, the torque will be to want to align or anti-align the magnetic moments of the two layers, depending on the direction of current, it turns out. The torque out of the plane, which is the normal precessional kind of torque that you would have in, say, an RKKY-type interaction, that's much smaller in these non-equilibrium effects, though this is the dominant effect in most kinds of equilibrium problems. Okay, so to make anything real, you need to have a bit more complicated device because you need some way of forming the spin porous current before it bangs on this magnet and causes a torque. So that means you have to think about at least two magnetic films. And with what we've done so far, we have a very simple picture of what happens here. An interesting thing that results is the direction of the torque here will depend on the direction of the current. And it's fairly easy to see how that will happen. Basically, I want to perform kind of a linear stability analysis here. There's no torque if the magnets are completely aligned with each other. So I'll imagine a small deviation in the magnetization direction of two magnets and ask when I pass a current whether the current will want to force the magnets apart or push them back together again. So let's imagine we have two magnets which have a small deviation between them. Normally, for thin film magnets, the magnetization would always be in the plane, but I can't draw that. It doesn't turn out to matter. So just imagine those are some slightly different angle. And now let's imagine that we pass current from right to left here, or electrons passing right to left through the device. So as electrons pass through the first magnet, they'll be filtered. They'll pick up a magnetization direction sort of tilted in the direction I've drawn. And then when those encounter this magnet, we know that that magnet will feel torque as to want to line up with the incoming electrons. That means that will push the spins the magnet this way. And so that means the current will act as a stabilizing force here. It will want to push the magnetization directions together. However, if you reverse the current down here, now you have to take into account one more reflection. Electrons will come through this layer. They'll be spin filtered. They'll come up this direction, and they'll hit this magnet. They'll apply a torque there. But in this geometry, I'm imagining I'm having a very thick magnetic layer here, so it doesn't respond to the torque. It just stays fixed like a thick wall. But then electrons will be reflected off this layer with the opposite direction of spin, come back and hit this layer, and those reflected electrons can give a net torque in the opposite direction to want to anti-align the layers. So that means that within this model, you have a dependence on current. You can stabilize a parallel orientation one way with one direction of current, and you can destabilize the parallel orientation by passing current the other way. And that's nice because it gives you the first ingredient from a magnetic memory device. Just with two leads, you can force magnetization one way or the other. And actually, what happens after things are destabilized is something I'll come to in a minute. I'll just mention that these more complicated devices can also be handled within the scattering formalism, very similar to a Fabry-Perot interferometer, but taking spin into account. And Xavi Weintal and Pete Brouwer have worked out that, and there's a nice paper that explains things very clearly with some other results with supernetting leads as well. Okay, so once you have these torques, you might ask what happens. And that gets to be a bit more complicated problem because there's all kinds of other torques that can act on magnets too. And it's not entirely clear exactly where this angular momentum is going when it hits the magnet, whether it will all go into the magnetization and make the magnetization move, whether much of it might go to phonons. You're just treating it as a black box, so you don't know exactly what's happening here. But at least experimental evidence indicates that much of it goes to reorient the magnetic moment. So within a full approach, you'd want to actually use something called the Landau-Lipschitz-Gilbert equation to understand the dynamics of the full magnetic motion. And that occurs a number of different forces. Any kind of effective field acting on the magnet, including anisotropy forces and the real field, will make any magnet tilted from that direction want to process around. What the spin transfer will be to push the magnetic moment either toward or away from the direction of the applied field, depending on what the sign of the current is. So it acts more like a damping term. If the current's in one direction, it actually reinforces the damping and makes the magnetic moment relax faster back to its equilibrium position. But for the other direction of current, it can act against the damping. And if the spin transfer force is stronger than the damping force, that's when you can get an instability, and you can have the current produce a larger and larger precession angle, moving the magnet away from its equilibrium position. So there's two possibilities of what can happen there. It can either go all the way 180 degrees and get stuck, in which case you then have to reverse the current to get it back to go back to where it was before. Or it's also possible in some cases to have it sort of get stuck somewhere in between and have a dynamic equilibrium state where it continues to process around at some high frequency in a stable configuration. So the DC current's driving a high frequency precession. And we've seen evidence of both those effects. So the first indication of this effect we're seeing in small point contact devices. It's hard to get very quantitative with those devices. So these days, we're working entirely within what we call nanopillar devices. These are in the range of 50 to 100 nanometers across. They're made by sputtering a magnetic multilayer with gold on top, using ion etching to etch a pillar-shaped device, and then coming and making a low-resistance contact to the top. And so again, we have the geometry I've been talking about, a thick magnetic layer, which will be fixed in response to the currents, a thin magnetic layer on the order of a few nanometers thick, which can be free to be reoriented by the currents, and then we can pass current perpendicular to the layers and measure what goes on. Okay, our best results have come by making pillars which aren't round, but have some shape anisotropy built into them. So there's only two directions the magnetization wants to point, either sort of right or left along the long axis of the device. And this is the sort of data you get in that situation. You can produce a switching between the different magnetic orientations of this film by passing current one way or another through the device. and you can measure what direction things are pointed by looking at the resistance because of the giant magnetic resistance effect. So if the two magnetic layers in our device are pointed in the same direction, we get a low resistance state. If they're pointed anti-parallel to each other, we get a high resistance state, and we can use the current to switch between those states. So for instance here, if we start in this configuration, we have the low resistance state, that's the parallel orientation of the magnets. If we pass a large current, or a few milliamps in the direction at which it's predicted to want to turn the moments anti-parallel to each other, we jump up to a high resistance state, which corresponds to anti-parallel alignment. That can be stable at zero current. You can have a bistable memory kind of device. And if you turn the current the other direction, you can destabilize the anti-parallel orientation and switch them back to parallel again and go back down to the low resistance state. And you can verify that that actually does correspond to changing between parallel and anti-parallel alignment, because you can also drive that transition with a magnetic field, and you get the same change in resistance there. So the symmetry here is indicative of the spin transfer effect, very different than a magnetic field kind of effect. In large devices, we've also seen that. And also, the currents here are too small to generate the reorientation strictly by means of magnetic fields, so you have to have some other mechanism based on the stronger exchange interaction. One test you can have to make sure you really understand what's going on is to look at what happens when you change the thickness of this thin layer that's moving around. You expect the forces you're fighting against to get the reorientation to scale with the thickness of your film, because that's what the way anisotropy forces and things like that scale. So the theory for what's going on in these devices is that the net torque is deposited almost entirely at the surface of the film. So what that means if that's happening, then you would expect to need larger currents to reverse the magnets for larger thicknesses. And that is what we see. We see a linear dependence of the critical current on the thickness of this free layer. So that says we have some understanding what's going on here. It really is a deposition of spinning momentum at the interface of these devices that's causing this reorientation. So simple switching is only one of the results that can happen in these devices. You can also have situations where you drive this dynamical state and get a spin precession. So putting on a DC current, you get out a precessing arrangement. And this is actually first seen by Jack Bass's group at Michigan State in collaboration with people from Noble. Maxime Soy was the first author in those papers. But we've seen similar results in both our pillar and our point contact devices. Again, the basic idea here is that the current-induced torque can destabilize the parallel orientation of these magnets, and can cause their angles to deviate. But at high magnetic fields, we don't seem to see the magnetization going all the way around reversing 180 degrees, but it gets stuck somewhere in between and processes around at a state where the current-induced torque balances the damping torque, and you have some equilibrium state. So the way you can see that is in these kinds of graphs, where I'm plotting the DC resistance now versus magnetic field. At a high current density where you expect these spin-dependent torques to be important, at very high fields, the magnetic field wins, and you have a parallel orientation of the magnets. At zero field, actually, there's fairly strong anti-ferromagnetic coupling in these devices, so that you have an anti-parallel arrangement. But in between, there's a stable state over a range of magnetic field where there you have a resistance in between what a parallel and anti-parallel orientation would give. And that means, that obviously suggests you have some angle in between parallel and anti-parallel orientation that's stabilized by this strong current. You also see transitions if you look at the differential resistance as a function of current. When you pop into the state, you get a jump up in the differential resistance. Recently, Maxime Soy and the Grenoble group of Michigan State have actually observed directly the high frequency spin precession by applying an AC field and mixing down the signal within the point contact geometry, and actually are able to measure the precession of these frequencies of these precession states. So that's the most direct evidence you actually have a precession in that case.
Short question, Dan. Yeah. I
think it's best to think about things as being continuous in this sort of situation. Well, what goes on here is you have a critical current to turn on the state to destabilize the parallel orientation that occurs that depends on magnetic field. So there's nothing necessarily quantum about that. you aren't necessarily exciting, just giving enough energy to excite a quantum, but you're balancing damping versus excitation, and you have a crossover because of that. That's at least the picture we have. Okay, so that's the simple picture. The most recent data is actually trying to understand these things quantitatively, and it gets a bit trickier there. It seems the complications come in understanding the magnetic dynamics, which can be complicated in these kinds of devices. So the pictures I've shown you so far are all kind of single domain pictures. We expect that what's going on in these devices is, at least when we start driving them hard, they're not entirely single domain and things become more complicated. But I'll at least show you some evidence of that in the next few graphs. Okay. But at least in the simple torque picture, there should be a simple prediction for what the critical current should be in the arrangement of anisotropy fields and magnetic fields that we have in our devices. That the destabilizing current should have a simple form like this. It should depend linearly on magnetic field with an offset that's given vectorally by the anisotropy field in the magnet. And the slope should be given by the damping coefficient. The idea there is simple. If you apply a larger magnetic field, you process faster. That means in the usual magnetic kinds of theories, you give up energy faster. And so if you're balancing spin transfer versus damping, at higher magnetic fields, you need to give more energy to the torque to have that destabilization happen. So if we look at where the switching currents happen, both at low field where we see reversal and at high field where we see this sort of precessional state occurring, at high field we do see effectively a nice linear dependence. And the slope that we measure gives us a damping coefficient that's reasonable for these devices that agrees, say, with ferromagnetic resonance measurements. However, there's a number of things which don't agree with simple theories. The offset is off by more than a factor of 2, and we think that's something we should understand because that's just given by simple anisotropy, and we know what the anisotropy is in these devices. So that says something more complicated than the simple picture is going on, and we think that more complication is not having a single domain magnet. The other complication is that within the simple pictures, you expect both the switching current at low field and the precessional state at high field to be given by the same formula for the critical current. These data should lie along the same line, too, according to simple theories, and they don't. They have a different slope and a different offset. And that means, again, that something more complicated is going on in the dynamics of these devices. The other tests we're working on are trying to understand the dynamics, are to do things both fast and slow and see how the dynamics occurs. One thing we're doing with Roger Koch at IBM is putting very fast current pulses on the magnets and watching for the probability that reversal actually occurs in these devices. So if the current is too small, no matter what the pulse width, you don't get much switching. If you turn the current amplitude up a bit more, you see beyond a certain pulse width, you can see almost 100% switching probability. But the strange thing in these data is that if you turn the pulse width up even more, that the current probability drops back down almost to zero again, and then goes back up again. So our explanation of what's going on here, well, and then where that minima occurs changes according to what kind of current amplitude you have. As you apply more current, you need shorter pulse widths to get back down to that zero switching state. We think this is evidence for some kind of real precessional dynamics, what's going on, that probably this can tilt the magnet up, and then it can process around in a demagnetization field. If it processes all the way around once, you get back to where you started and there's no switching. If it processes around different amounts, you get back down to full switching again. Within that picture, we'd expect to see multiple minima. We don't see that, but that's our best shot of the data so far. We're just beginning to make real simulations of what might be going on here. But we think this is some sort of evidence for precessional dynamics. If we look at things very slowly, we see different behaviors. There it looks like we're seeing some sort of over the barrier type motion rather than some sort of precessional motion, which really isn't described by the simple theories at all yet. And is again probably another indication of something beyond a single domain theory. So what we're doing here is looking at the sort of the histogram of what the critical current is as we make slow sweeps through the region where magnetic switching occurs for different sweep rates of the current. And we see a very stochastic nature of where the switching field occurs with broad distributions of the switching current that depend on what the amplitude of the current sweep rate is. And this is sort of the classical behavior that people have seen for a long time for magnetic switching, where you're having an over-the-barrier type transition that's thermally activated. We're in the midst of taking temperature-dependent data right now. But this says that the dynamics for slow sweep rates is probably very different for fast sweep rates, again, probably because you don't have single domain magnets. Okay, so that's sort of where I'll conclude. The two take-home messages are, first of all, the simple message that g-factor fluctuations in metal nanoparticles are pretty well described by random matrix theory for non-magnetic systems. And the second message is that spin transfer from spin-wise currents can produce various kinds of magnetic excitations in small magnets that possibly can be useful, but there's still lots of questions about exactly what is the nature of the scattering mechanisms that give the torques in these devices, and even stranger, what are the true dynamics of these small magnets, and how do those figure into giving switching or precessional states? That's where I'll stop.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Is there some analogy with the spin wave instability which appears during parametric pumping?
Yeah, I think there's lots of things that need to be done in terms of the nonlinear spin wave things that come in. One thing that I'm very curious about is, at least for the magnetic reversal, we don't seem to see a Sewell instability in these devices. Maybe they're small enough that that's not important. But we're tilting, the basic idea of these theories is we're tilting things by very large angles, and we'd expect all kinds of nonlinear spin wave physics to come in. We're just beginning to think about those things. So if you have ideas about that, please let me know. But I think those that very well could be important to all that kind of physics. We haven't really investigated that in great detail yet, because it's hard to measure these switchings in real time. It's just signals and noise trouble. We're working on that, and I'm going to corner Rob Schulkoff while we're both here and try to get all the knowledge about that I can get out of his brain. I can give you what the theoretical numbers are, and they're comparable to the precessional times, precessional frequencies. So it should be a nanosecond, maybe a few nanoseconds for the reversal times. But that's not something we've been able to measure yet.
In the first part of the book, where you had a transition of the G factor, then you fitted one parameter with the spin orbit, and you said for different for the same material, different samples, I mean, you had quite big variation. I mean, is it possible to make some estimates, I mean, based on the sample you have, to explain the difference between the...
I don't know. We haven't tried to go into great quantitative detail about exactly what the say how that should depend on shape and things. I was looking at Pete and he was shrugging his shoulders. So
how strong is that? I mean, what's the factor of the difference?
For copper, it was tens of percent for what the average G factor is. So I mean, it's sort of if you plot the two distributions, they don't even really overlap very much for the two different samples. So, but it's comparable to the width of the distribution.
You mentioned this G factor and this tensor factor. Do I understand correctly that this is due to the orbital motion of electrons in the ring with the imperfect shape?
We haven't measured that yet. We're just setting up now with a magnet that can point in any direction to try to measure that. So I don't have anything experimentally to say about that. The theory is Pete's, though, if he wants to say, what is it? It's a mesoscopic effect that depends on the wave function.
But the effect, I mean, there can be an orbital component, but it's been loading enough to get the tensor character.
Are there any similar effects in GMR systems? I mean, switching between parallel and anti-parallel magnetization of the current, which is perpendicular to the wave.
These are GMR systems.
GMR
systems,
but you have just two waves, right?
If you have many layers, it becomes kind of complicated because you can get competitions between the direction of torque from the electrons coming from the two sides. We're actually, one of the things we're trying to do is control that and build up multi-layers where we get effectively bigger signals and noise for these effects. And that's complicated. I think you'd need to have effects where you actually have controlled amounts of spin orbit scattering between the layers to make sure that everything gets torqued the direction you want it to get torqued. Because it's easy to get things with reflections backward from what you want in that situation. The same kind of formalism we use for understanding it can describe that, but you need to take into account sort of all the reflections of electrons from all different layers to actually calculate what the true torques would be. It gets complicated, but maybe not impossibly complicated. Yeah, so we're in a situation where kind of the orbital effects are all quenched out by disorder or shape, and everything left is spin. And in that sort of situation, it's unlike atomic physics. The spin orbit will always just reduce the G factor. It won't increase it. I think in semiconductor quantum dots, you can get a different sort of situation where the G factor will be increased. But in metals, where everything is just spin physics, it's reduced. No, the G factor for gold was much smaller than for copper. Let me get that back up again.
So the G factor is different from ESR?
Yes. Yes. So, well, so the gold is over here, and the copper is over here. So it's a much smaller G factor.
The reduction is larger.
The reduction is larger. So this is from 0 to 2. Yeah, I mean, the ESRG factor is actually bigger than 2 even for gold. So it's a different physical quantity.
But we don't see saturation.
Well, this saturation just means that all the G factors are less than this value. This is the integrated probability. If you put one, just plot the regular probability distribution, you'd have, you know, a peak here, and it would come down to 0 again. It's just a way of applying the data to make a comparison when you don't have that many data points. But you can't combine data from different samples because different samples are different, so that's what we have to do. Perhaps. Again, that's not something we've tried to do, but this just measures the magnitudes, what we have so far. We don't know which data spin up and which data spin down. But there have been some suggestions in the theory literature about ways to do that, or at least to know when you have the anisotropic G factor, the tensor, when some components are positive and when some are negative. And so that's a possibility, but we have no way yet of making comparison to that.
No more questions. Go ahead.
No, that's, things are always treated very phenomenologically, at least in the literature that I've read there. They just throw in this phenomenological damping parameter, and well, there's all kinds of strange things I didn't get into along those lines. If you just use the usual theory where, say, you have a constant damping as a function of tilt angle, you actually wouldn't expect to see any stable precessional state. You either expect to see either completely aligned or completely anti-aligned. And so in order to see things stable, we need to have some way of having the phenomenological damping parameter increase as the tilt angle increases, and so it can get caught up at some finite angle. That might be an effect of breaking up, not having a single domain anymore, but damping energy out into other kinds of spin wave modes. There might be things people haven't taken into account in terms of surface effects, things like that. I think it's really a field that it's not understood. One thing we can say is that in our different kinds of devices, in the point contacts versus the pillar devices, we see very different effective dampings there by about a factor of 100. Which indicates that you have different kinds of damping, whether you're forming a domain inside a big film or having something moving off sort of an isolation. But there's lots that's not understood in these kinds of situations.
Okay, now it's lunchtime. Thank you for your contribution.